From Mr. Ebert. This is a scummy little sewer of a movie. The people who made this have every right to be ashamed of themselves.
Sounds like our kind of movie.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, lords and lunatics, to another crazy good episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Rejects Weekly, cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, insane in the membrane, and I am joined by my mad co-host, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Insane in the brain.
Insane in the brain. There's literally a guy in Cypress Hill who all he does is, insane in the brain! That's it. That's his whole job. Yeah, he's...
Well, because nobody does it better than him. That, you know, that's if you true. Have one thing that you do, do it well. And
do
he
it well.
Says insane in the membrane so well that it made that whole song a hit.
He's like a miniature hype man. He's like a pseudo hype man. Anyway,
like a miniature hype man, like in Die Actburn or whatever that thing is that everybody's going nuts over.
The what?
What's the South African, the Afrikaner rap group?
Oh, you got me.
Die Antworks, that's what it is.
You are far more versed in weird world music than I am.
Oh, okay. the people in Chappie.
Oh, okay. All right, there you go.
Die Antworks, yeah, they have a very small hype man.
I'm
not lying.
You know who else was a really small hype man? Was the little guy from Island of Dr. Moreau. I mean, yes. he was Marlon Brando's hype man, if nothing else.
But you've got Tattoo, the greatest, smallest hype man in the world.
Boom.
Z-Plane, boss.
The plane.
Z-Plane. Who didn't get excited when he said
that? He got you excited about every single approaching aircraft, so kudos to you, Hervé Villechaize. I want to remind you that brilliance like that can be found on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We are still very much in the throes of March Madness here at Junk Food Cinema, highlighting and celebrating our favorite psychos, schizos, and madmen in film. This week's entry pits Madness against Macho, Charles Bronson starring in 10 to Midnight.
Charles Bronson is a cop looking for a killer, and he's running out of time. A Golan Globus production of a J. Lee Thompson film, 10 to Midnight.
You know, I'm surprised I was waiting the whole time for the theme song to kick in. Because, you know, the theme song was so popular for the longest time.
Are you talking about Threat Level Midnight?
No. 10 to Midnight. He's going to let it all hang out.
Yes, I believe that is exactly why that song was written, and I have no reason to believe it was anything else. Good, we're off to a good start.
Good, the beer is working.
The beer is
working. The microphones are working.
Yes, both of those things
are true. It's crazy month, so we can totally write this off.
Yay! We're just insane. This was the first of Charles Bronson's many projects with Canon Films, a favorite company of ours. And in fact, after this point, Canon Films got to a point where they made so much money regularly off of Charles Bronson and Chuck Norris that every single script that came across their desks, Golan and Globus' desk, got put into one of two of the Chuck piles.
The Chuck piles.
It was either Chuck Bronson or Chuck Norris.
And you would chuck it into a Chuck pile.
Could
you imagine being like a producer in that era?
Have been a producer for them.
Yeah, but no, to be sitting there and get this really brilliant script and you're like, but there's no place for either of the Chucks.
And then Menahem Golan's just like, well, fucking find one. We gotta sell this thing.
Look, just put some flags in it and some American beer and put Chuck in it.
Yeah, I mean, these are the guys that made Roger Corman look like, I don't know, Richard Zanuck. I mean, these were like shysters to the nth degree. In fact, the story of how this movie got made is pretty apropos to the overall flim-flammery that epitomized Canon Films. They had a script called Bloody Sunday, okay? And they weren't sure what to do with the script. And at the same time, they were negotiating a deal with Charles Bronson to make his next film. Now, Charles Bronson wanted to make a film version of R. Lance Hill's novel, The Evil That Men Do. And, you know, at this time, Golan Globus, they were already preparing to go to Cannes. They were like, okay, we're going to get something worked out with Bronson, and then we're going to pitch that at Cannes, and we're going to get all the money we need at Cannes. Well, turned out that the Evil That Men Do adaptation was going to cost way too much money. So they were like, we're not doing that, but we're still going to do your next movie, Bronson. So they call this producer who's already at Cannes, this producer named Pancho Kohner. And they basically make him sell a new project on the spot. They're like, we're not doing Evil That Men Do, but we need you to sell whatever we decide to do with Bronson next. So he comes up with this title, 10 to Midnight.
Which has nothing to do with the movie whatsoever.
Well, there was no movie. He just came up with a title. It's just 10 to Midnight, and we've got Charles Bronson. And he basically spouts taglines and buzzwords. He's like, it's a film featuring action, danger, and revenge. And he fucking sells it.
Yeah.
He sells it. And then when
look, if somebody said, hey, Brian, I've got this movie, it stars Charles Bronson, and it's about action, adventure, and danger, and it's going to be sexy, and there's going to be girls with boobs, and it's going to be really awesome, you're going to fucking watch that movie. You will pay to watch that movie.
They would have had me at Bronson.
Yes.
But what was great is they got back and they're like, hey, we already have this script called Bloody Sunday. Let's just rework it and call it 10 to Midnight. So again, 10 to Midnight has nothing to do with anything that happens at any point in this movie.
And thus, U2 was able to go on and write a hit.
There you go. This is the very musical episode that we've painted ourselves into here. But yeah, again, like this is what you can come to expect from Cannon Films. Ten to Midnight has the distinct pleasure of being directed by J. Lee Thompson. Now, J. Lee Thompson is one of my absolute favorite forgotten directors. And he's not just an exploitation guy. I mean, he's not a guy like, you know, like Larry Cohen or, any of the innumerable kind of schlockmeisters that we really love. This is a guy who early on in his career was doing, like, legitimately great movies. I mean, he directed the original Cape Fear with Gregory Peck.
Guns of Navarone.
And Guns of Navarone. Like, I mean, and not only that, Gregory Peck put J. Lee Thompson into a list of people who he said were the only people that could really get him to focus and deliver a great performance. I mean, in that same category was Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes.
So, I mean, J. Lee Thompson, highly respected director, and then
The 80s happened.
Now, I also want to point out that J. Lee Thompson directed Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. And Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is my absolute favorite film of that entire franchise. And in fact, Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
It's the one with the apes, right?
Yeah, it's the one with the apes, yeah. Okay. Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the first reboot that Rupert Wyatt did, borrows heavily from Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. It's violent, it's racially charged, and it's the most culturally relevant of the Planet of the Apes movies because it's a Planet of the Apes movies that's really about the Watts riots. So, I mean, you know, do with that what you will. And he worked, here's the best part, this was his fourth collaboration with Charles Bronson. They would work together 9 times, including a few films for canon, like Murphy's Law, The Evil That Men Do, and Death Wish 4 The Crackdown, which, according to my research, is the best critically received of the Death Wish sequels. Did not expect that, but apparently it's true.
So they did end up, for those of you, playing along with the home game, they did eventually make The Evil That Men Do.
They did. They did actually make that movie, and it's not great. It is not a great film, but 10 to Midnight that we are talking about tonight is a pretty spectacular movie.
You know, that's the thing, is it is... If ever you pulled a film out of your hat that you had seen that I had not, mm-hmm. that epitomized the point of this podcast, everything we set out to do, a movie that I've been hearing about since I was a kid, I knew the basic gist of it, you know, cop tracking a serial killer, 80s, early Golan Globus, you know, not really loved, but I knew it. And I particularly knew that title, but this movie is one of those movies that hits a point where it does something that you have never seen before or since. Like, since you haven't seen this movie, mm-hmm. and you find yourself in the third act of this movie in brand new territory where you're like, what the fuck is going to happen now? Like, what? Right. Where is this going?
Yeah.
And it's really, really good. This is a movie that, warts and all, it has issues, but all of those issues are so forgivable by how good the boldness of this story is.
And it's funny because it was created to be a mashup. The basic idea that Golden Globes had is we're going to combine a vigilante movie, a Charles Bronson vigilante movie with a slasher film. Because now keep in mind, when they started making this, it was 1982.
Yep.
And the slasher film was still very much the rage. So they were like, we're going to find a way to basically combine Charles Bronson's Death Wish movies with a slasher film. And frankly, I feel this is the thing missing from every single slasher franchise, where the inevitable Jason versus Paul Kersey, or, you know, Freddy Krueger versus Paul Kersey. I mean, when you think about it, the vigilantism displayed by Charles Bronson in the Death Wish movies could have easily thwarted even the scariest boogeyman. So I'm just saying, this is a glimpse of what should have been happening in every single slasher franchise.
But what's interesting is, as much as there's the vigilantism, he's very toned down. Like, they actually go to great efforts to sell us on the idea that he's an asshole, because you just kind of want to like him. Like,
yeah.
In this movie, he's very huggable. Like, he just is. He's this dad who's distant from his daughter, but you can tell that he loves his daughter, and he's busting the balls of his new partner.
Yeah.
But he's a good cop, and the only people he's an asshole to are the people cops should be assholes to. Like, he's not an asshole to someone on the street. He's an asshole to the reporter who's in there trying to get details and, you know, giving him, you know, trying to be his best friend so he'll give him the scoop on the serial killer case. And, you know, he tells him to go fuck himself, and then we get the title credits.
Yeah, like, there's no other reason for that opening. Like, that reporter never shows up again.
Nope.
That doesn't become a subplot. It's literally just, hey, watch this cop show dedication to being a cop, and then boom, title card.
While being an asshole. But so we keep getting told that he's an asshole, but he really is just kind of a rough around the edges good guy. And he's up against a serial killer that the only movie you can really, really, truly liken this to. There are two movies that I think you can liken this the most to. One we talked about just a few months back, New Year's Evil.
Uh-huh.
And the other would be Silence of the Lambs.
Ooh, wow. That's high praise.
It is.
And for me, both of those comparisons are high praise.
Yeah. No, that's the thing. But here we have this serial killer who we spend more time with than we spend the cops.
Oh, absolutely.
And he is very smart.
Yes.
He's very clever. He's good at what he does for the most part. He's still a creepy fucker. He's very clearly Ted Bundy kind of setup, the good looking, but a guy that is really off putting to a lot of people and everybody kind of thinks is creepy. And frankly, the girls who he spends time around with in the typing pool are all waiting for the chainsaw to come through the door at any moment. Like, they know this dude's creepy, but he's so smart that he's going on a killing spree and nobody can catch him.
Well, here's the thing. So the character of Warren Stacy, played by Gene Davis, is actually an amalgam of three actual figures in real criminal cases. The first is Richard Speck, who murdered 8 student nurses in Chicago in 1966, thus the third act of this movie.
Yep.
And then there was a Scotland Yard detective who was actually fired for planting evidence to try and catch the Thames River killer.
Yep.
So that plays a part in this movie. And the last one is Ted Bundy, but specifically Ted Bundy in the sense that he looked so much like Ted Bundy. But the difference between this killer and Ted Bundy is that they actually go out of their way to establish that he is a creep. Like, Ted Bundy would charm women.
Oh, yeah.
And lure women. This guy's not luring anybody.
No, he was really, really super charming and likable and got a lot of people to like him, including the people who were interviewing him and who dealt with him through that case. So that's why I said kind of, because
right.
That's where they miss the Bundy thing. But I feel like it's intentional. Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting too, because so many serial killer movies try to have you develop at least, maybe not empathy is not the right word,
right?
But at least an understanding, and you come to like appreciate the killer in some form or fashion. They sell you on the charm. This is a completely different. And in fact, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that, you know, like you were talking about, every woman that he works with is just like very, like, doesn't want him around. Really, they really creep him out. And, you know, they go so far to establish in this movie that he's a weirdo creep that at one point, Bronson finds a rudimentary fleshlight in his apartment.
Yes.
And I don't know. Let me tell you something. You haven't lived. You haven't lived on this planet until you've heard a 60-year-old Charles Bronson say,
"What is this used for? It's for jacking off.
It's for jacking off, isn't it?" It's just like, oh my god, oh my god. Like
that scene's amazing.
Charles Bronson brandishing a fleshlight, like, "What is this? It's for jacking off, isn't it?" It's like, yes, Charlie. That's for jacking off.
Yeah, this movie, what I find interesting about it, though, is what they're selling you. And they're selling you an idea better than they totally execute it, mm-hmm. but they execute it well enough that you buy it. It's the idea that the audience knows who the killer is. The police know who the killer is. Even his coworkers know who the fucking killer is, but nobody can fucking prove it.
And this is where the vigilante thing comes in.
And that's where we hit what happens in the end of the second act going into the third act. Because for the first, and I want to talk about the first two acts before we get there.
Sure.
Because that's where this movie goes. It doesn't go off the rails. It gets on the rails. Like it gets on a completely different track that you've never been on before. And you're like, what fucking movie is this? Because for the first two acts of this movie is exactly what you sit down and strap in for with a Charles Bronson movie. It's Charles Bronson. He's got a new partner. You know, the new partner's a little different. He's got this daughter. The daughter has daddy issues built upon daddy issues. And then starts falling for his partner.
Yeah.
You know, you see all this stuff kind of happening. You know, the killer is creepy. He does something weird that just unsettles you, the audience, because at this point they know, look, everyone's seen the serial killers. You know, we're not going to be able to outgore these slasher movies. So what are we going to do? We're going to have very pretty, attractive young women slaughtered by a knife wielded by a naked, muscly guy.
And here is the rub. I mean, that sounds like an absolute schlocky exploitation gimmick just to hook people. Oh, he's a naked serial killer. But the thing about this guy is that he's, not only is he's smart to the point that he defies exploitation expectation and also kind of precedes history. Okay, and by that I mean this. So the idea of stripping nude before each kill, I mean, it seems like a gimmick, but he does this so that he doesn't leave any physical evidence whatsoever and that there's no evidence on his clothes. The weird thing about this is that, again, remember, they shot this movie in 1982. It was released in 1983. 10 to Midnight was released 2 years before DNA testing became part of the criminal justice process.
Yep.
So you have a killer who's keenly aware of DNA evidence even before that's a thing.
Yeah, in fact, in the movie, when they're dealing with the blood type, they're like, yep, it's type A, it's a rare blood thing, and we've got dormant hepatitis, that's how we know it's the same blood.
Right.
And it's like, no DNA testing, because what the fuck is DNA testing?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, but he sets up these really great alibis.
That's the other thing, too, is the way the first two girls so in that first kill, we watch him follow two girls into a movie theater. He harasses them. He stalks them a little bit. And we sit there thinking, well, clearly, he's going to kill them.
Yes.
I mean, any other serial killer movie, these are his first victims.
He goes back into the bathroom. He pulls on plastic gloves. He climbs up into something that we assume takes him towards the projection booth. What the fuck's going on? And yeah. The zinger is?
And he's intentionally making a negative impression on these girls in the theater to establish an ironclad alibi for the murder he's actually going out to commit.
And then he comes back from the murder, washes off, jumps back in the theater, and is sitting there. When they stand up to walk out, he goes and starts hitting on them again, has another negative experience with them, and then sure enough, there's his alibi. I was at this movie. I talked to these girls. You know, the front desk girl's gonna remember me. Why? Because I asked for the name of the other girl. Clearly, he was there. You know,
he's brilliant.
Yeah,
he's a total creep, but he's brilliant.
Yeah, and that is what makes this movie so interesting. Is you have these two cops. They know who did it, but they just can't quite find the evidence to prove it.
Right.
Which takes us to the end of the second act and the decision our hero makes to actually plant evidence on this guy. And here's what I think in terms of storytelling is so great. He plants evidence on the clothes he was wearing the night of the murder. And right away,
the guy knows this planet because he wasn't wearing any clothes.
And you know it because you know that, you know, even though you've seen it, but I mean, it's, you know why it all makes sense. And so, you know, and I love it because in that moment, the serial killer flips the fuck out. I mean, he flips out.
He throws a chair at Bronson.
and the fucking, his lawyer is just sitting there. Guy's been in like 200 movies. We were talking about him a few weeks back. Worked with Clint Eastwood.
Jeffrey Lewis?
Yes.
That plays his lawyer. Yeah.
Yeah, Jeffrey Lewis. He gets this look on his face. He's like, oh, fuck, this guy totally did it. And later on, he's like talking to him. He's like, okay, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this and this. But we've got it all worked out for the crazy defense just in case. You know, and he's like, but I'm not crazy. He's like, I know that. And you know that. But, you know, a crazy guy, you know, you get to walk out of the, you know, the loony bin in several years, if you're crazy. If you're not, they'll carry you out of the gas chamber.
Such a great line.
Yeah,
such a great
line. And what this sets up in the third act is you now have a serial killer that's pissed. You have a cop who has broken the law. And the decisions that get made from there, we won't spoil here because those decisions make for a wonderful third act where you're just like, where is this going?
Yeah.
It's just so good. Like the minute this happens, there's so many ways it can go. And the ways they decide to play it in this film, they really take the interesting morality route. And it gets a little heavy handed towards the end when they're trying to drive home their message. And yet you don't give a shit because the what's happening in the story and the ideas they're playing with are so good.
Well, but see, heavy handed, yes. But
yeah.
But the reason it works for me is I feel like it's such an effective counterpoint to the Death Wish, Charles Bronson, because again, he's still very, the spirit of the Paul Kersey character is alive and well in this cop. I mean, he's still very much of the mindset of what's right supersedes what's legal because he's frustrated with how the legal system actually works. So that is why he makes the decision to plant the blood on the character. He's a vigilante working within the system.
Yes.
And yet he faces a moral crisis and he
spoiler time, by the way.
I'm sorry.
The spoilers that I was trying to avoid earlier.
Is that what you were trying to avoid?
Well, because I think that is the strongest point of the story.
Okay.
I think when we get to all that 10 minutes of this film, it's just like, holy shit, I literally don't know what these characters are going to do. They have so wonderfully set these characters up. They have given them an amazing moral dilemma I've not seen before. And I don't know how they're going to react.
Then I'll just bleep out what I said.
Yes. Bleep that out.
There's the bleep.
Yeah.
You enjoy that.
Yeah.
It wasn't me just saying cunt nuggets for 5 minutes. It was just a spoiler.
Yeah. The thing is what he spoiled really is the reason to watch this movie. Aside from all the beautiful cast of young naked starlets.
So many 80s boobs in this
movie. So many 80s boobs in this movie. There's so many women gutted with knives. There is this guy's naked ass, which exists for like a quarter of the film, it feels like, that is designed, especially in the early 80s, to make you feel awkward. Mm. So much so, there's a hilarious shot in which we're watching the guy stalking around a bed in a dark room. He's naked, and they have set the camera up perfectly so the bar of the bed is right where his junk is.
Right at dick height, yeah.
Right at dick height. So you see pubes, you see leg, you see abs, but we're not going to show you any peen because that would make 80s people uncomfortable. You in the shower who's just heard your friend get murdered, why don't you turn off the water and turn so we can get a perfect shot of your boobs? Because that is much more socially acceptable.
But I want to point something out. And we are talking about the violence in this movie. We are talking about a killer who murders with knives. But I'm gonna read another line here from Roger Ebert's review that I really take issue with. May he rest in peace. He says the movie revels in its bloodbaths and that gore spurts all over the screen and the final sequence is so disgusting. If you actually watch this movie, you never see a knife go into a body.
No.
And in fact, Variety at the time, and I think this is much more accurate, Variety praised J. Lee Thompson for taking more of a Hitchcock route, like in Psycho, where you never actually see any penetration with that knife. It's all, like, all the stabbing is kind of off-screen, just over here to the left, all kind of done with Foley. It's like, yes, there's blood, but you never actually see the acts of violence.
Well, I feel like the thing that Ebert was reacting to, Ebert only tended to react this way to films that really got under his skin. films that touched in a way. And then the thing is Ebert was always all over the map about this. He would go on, what, 3 or 4 years later, which what year was this released?
1983.
It was 83. So 4 years later, he would go on to praise RoboCop for all these same things. And then talk about how he was watching it with a room full of critics who just didn't get it. And they didn't get what this movie was doing with this. And everyone thought they were just reveling in it. And then he would go on just over 20 years later and write the antithesis of that review for Kick-Ass and talk about how morally repugnant Kick-Ass is. If you compare all three of these reviews, you see, you know, three different Eberts. And I think, you know, he picks based upon how he felt about that movie. And in the case of this movie, I really feel like this movie was intended. This was made by the guy who made Cape Fear. Yeah. He was trying to make an 80s movie that got under your skin in a post-slasher movie era.
He was trying to make Max Cady the 80s slasher.
How do you do that? And that's what I very much feel he did. And this is not a fun movie.
No.
10 to Midnight is not a fun junk food cinema movie where you'll kick back and throw some popcorn and laugh your way all the way through. There are some laughs there, both intentional and unintentional. True. Like, there's some really great sharp dialogue in this movie. And then there's some acting so bad it rivals. There's a scene that rivals Troll 2. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it rivals Troll 2 in just how bad the acting is. So, you know, the acting's uneven, but the vibe is there, and this movie gets under your skin and creates a character that you detest in the serial killer, and you want to see caught, and it's constantly frustrating you that he's not, and you never enjoy the kills. Yeah. Like with slasher movies, you're not supposed to enjoy them, but you do in the way that, you know, in depending on the era, how it was intended. You know, in the late 80s, it was for fun. Hey, we're going to kill them in the most creative, fun ways possible. In the early 80s, it was like, okay, we're going to show some boobs, we're going to splatter some blood, and you're going to be scared and jump, but you're going to have fun doing it. This movie never lets you have fun with it. And to say that this movie revels in the gore, I think is being disingenuous. I feel like it was one of those days, as happens in Chicago, where they watched 3 or 4 films in a row, and this happened to be the second or third slasher film, mm-hmm. you know, or serial killer movie he saw in a day, and it blended together. Because that's not what this movie is at all.
Well, you know, if Ebert had specifically said that what was really unsettling and showed a lack of humanity was Charles Bronson's odd cosmetic surgery he had right before they started filming, then maybe we would have had a case, because it is odd.
It's a little disconcerting.
He's like, oh, I'm too old to play this character. I'm like, are you? I mean, I don't, like, you're 60.
A daughter who's supposed to be playing like 20-something and looks 30,
yeah,
so...
I don't think you were too old, and it's weird that this movie, of all the things he did, and all the movies he did after this, this is the one he felt he had to get cosmetic surgery to do.
Yeah.
Just very, a very strange choice. But going back to our killer for a second, I mean, we talked last week in Alone in the Dark about the specificity of the crazy. We've talked a little bit about how he strips naked to avoid, to avoid any kind of physical evidence. We also talked about how he's played as a complete sexual creep, so that you never as an audience member develop any attachment. But okay, so what surprised me most the first time I saw this movie is in the third act, when he starts harassing Bronson. The phone calls and all the little things that he does to try to get under Bronson's skin. Because at that point in the movie, for one reason or another, he feels invincible. He definitely feels like he is above everything. And however, Bronson, by the way, not a guy you traditionally fuck with. And when Bronson does the exact same thing to him, Bronson starts, you know, making phone calls and like leaving crime scene photos at the guy's job and just following him in his car. I mean, basically a even more low key version of what this killer is doing to him. The guy comes completely unraveled.
Yeah.
Like he completely falls apart.
He's not in control anymore, because he's a serial killer that needs to be in control, and he has lost control.
Well, the first few times I saw this movie, I thought this was an unfortunate corruption and an abandon of the character that they had created, that he so easily succumbs to his own methods. But then I realized something. They aren't making a contradictory statement about their killer. they're once again elevating Bronson to superhuman status.
Yes.
As if to say, even the craziest, most dangerous, hardened criminal will fold like an origami swan when they find themselves in Charles Bronson's crosshairs.
Yeah.
That's what they're really saying.
That's exactly Cannon's perspective on Charles Bronson from that point on.
He's fucking invincible.
Yeah.
He can turn the tables on the serial killer by you just look to your right and you see Charles Bronson following, and he's got this weird smile on his face when he's following him in the car.
Oh, that scene is so great.
Yeah.
Like, when the tables get turned in that way during that part of the movie, it's so solid. And what makes this movie work is I was having fun with that. I'm like, okay, this is fun, but I see where this is going. And then they flip it again where it's like, oh yeah, he thought he was in control. Then the serial killer outwits him and takes control again, because remember, this guy's fucking smart.
Yeah.
And it becomes cat and mouse from that point.
It's less cat and mouse and more two super smart cats playing chess. Because it is...
All right, okay.
Because it's back and forth.
I'll take that. It really is. It is two super, super, you know, brilliant cats playing chess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the third original title was, like, Super Cats Playing Chess.
Dude, you just made a movie the internet would watch forever. Forever.
Where's my internet money?
No, it's called Two Atheist Libertarian Super Cats Smoking Pot and Playing Chess. And that is the biggest movie on the internet of all time.
Wait. Playing chess on their Xbox One. So that it's a playthrough. So it's a let's play. I will take my billion theoretical dollars right now, YouTube. So, okay, you mentioned the... Okay, we've talked a lot about how good this movie is. We have to acknowledge the things that don't work.
There are a number of actors in this movie that you have never seen before and will never see again. In fact, there are pretty much only four actors from the film you will recognize. Jeffrey Lewis, we mentioned earlier, who's a popular character actor of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Like, if you've watched any genre of that era, you've seen it. Then, of course, we've got the father of diabetes himself.
I was waiting to see how long it would take us.
Yes, Wilford Brimley is the chief of police.
The chief of police who thinks he's in Texas.
Well, the weird thing is you make... Wilford Brimley's a guy you never give the job as chief of police. This is the weird thing, is that Wilford Brimley is one of those guys who... He grew old super quick. Like, people don't realize he was in his 40s in the 80s. When he made Cocoon, when he made The Thing, when he made this, he was younger than Brad Pitt is now.
Yikes.
Like, this is, he just was one of those guys who hit 35 and went, old man. And he played an old man from that point on. When he was on the show Our House, where he's the grandfather, he was in his 40s, for fuck's sake.
He is sitting in a shack outside of youth going, I want to come back inside. I went a little crazy for a minute. Now I want to come back inside.
But the thing is that what people learned is that Wilford Brimley is the nicest, most trustworthy man on the planet, which is why he became a spokesman for things. Because when people watch Wilford Brimley on TV, and when they watch him on the TV and Wilford Brimley says, I trust this, then I should trust that too, because Wilford Brimley trusts that and I trust Wilford Brimley.
Take this medication and won't take your foot.
Like, diabetes. Nobody ever questions whether Doc is infected in the thing. You never question Wilford Brimley. So making him the police chief was just kind of one of those weird choices that doesn't work, but doesn't not work either. It's just kind of like, oh, it's Wilford Brimley. But the daughter.
Yes.
And the serial killer and the cop are all actors that you really haven't spent much time seeing before and would never really see much again.
But there is one person in a very early role playing one of the other nurses in
Kelly Preston.
It's Kelly Preston.
And it is, you're watching, and she gets like three lines in the movie, and you're like, holy shit, it's Kelly Preston. What is she doing here? Oh, she's just eye candy in the background.
She's also credited as Kelly Palsies.
Yes, this is.
So this is pre-Preston.
This is pre-Preston. So you see her and you're just like, what the hell is she doing here? And then, of course, Charles Bronson. Like, those are the only four people you'll recognize. So then we have our three actors who are not so strong. They're not bad. They all give uneven performances.
Yeah.
And that is what I think is the second weakest point of this movie. The weakest point, which is also a selling point. There is a scene in which the woman who I believe is the head of human services, which is the kind way of the head of the secretary pool in the 80s.
Yeah.
There's all these women who are out there. This is back when we had a secretary pool.
Before, she's the steno queen.
Yes. Yeah. Before there were computers, we filled rooms with women and gave them typewriters and called it parody. And this woman gets the call that one of the girls who's been missing, who she has been griping about, who she has been slut-shaming
so hard.
For 5 minutes of this movie, she finds out that this woman was the murder victim this weekend. And there's this scene of her on the phone with the phone to her. What? No! No! And all the women stand up in the secretary pool and they're just like...
And I love, here's what I love. There is no attempt on her part whatsoever to keep things together and be professional. She marches out to the steno pool and almost like, if there was a pulpit, she would have climbed it. And she just is like, she's dead!
It's literally one of the worst moments of acting in history.
It's like Mrs. Garrett from Facts of Life. She's like, girls, she's dead! It's like, what am I looking at right now? I don't understand.
It's a scene that's such a non-sequitur. It doesn't need to exist. That sequence is not needed for the movie in any way, shape, or form. And on top of that, it just is so over the top that you're howling during a movie that you are otherwise unsettled during.
Yeah.
Like, and there's a few little bits of like wackety schmackety do acting that you're just like, what the fuck was that? But you kind of just brush past it. That's the film's biggest fault. And I think if there's anything you can seriously fault this film for, it's just how uneven the performances are, except from Charles Bronson.
Because there aren't a lot of highs and lows in a Bronson performance.
There really aren't.
Very, very, very steady. Very
I'm very angry right now.
I'm going to fucking kill you.
I'm going to have sex with you right now.
We're in love. Yeah. I've never felt happier in my life.
There's really...
What? Wait, what?
He's the pulse baseline. You know, any numbers that your doctor gives you as to what is normal. They just brought in Charles Bronson every day and just tested him for a year.
Right.
And that's clearly the number.
He's the control group actor.
Yes.
Charles Bronson is a control group actor. You're like, what's a typical emotional state? Well, if Charles Bronson represents no emotional state, then this performer over here is way too high on the emotional. Thanks, Charles Bronson.
Which I think might be lending itself to the problem with this movie, in that you have this, like, when people go to 11, they're going to 11 against Charles Bronson.
Mm-hmm.
The best acting in the movie is the pothead that he busts.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, it's scenes like that where there's actually good, you know, working actors who are like, okay, I'm playing pothead number one in this movie. All right. And he fucking nails it. And, but yeah, there's some uneven acting, and then just that really terrible scene where it's just like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
And, but up against that, the writing is so strong,
mm-hmm.
and the narrative is so strong, and the direction has a really good visual style, especially for the 80s, which the early 80s, these films were generally so cheaply made that they had no real aesthetic to them,
mm-hmm.
that it was just, let's point the camera and hope that it works. And occasionally, you know, you'd have like the big budget stuff, like Spielberg stuff, you know, anything Spielberg directed or produced, you know, you look at Poltergeist even now and you're like, this has such great visual language. And then you look at all the slasher films that came out the same fucking year in 1982. And you're like, how is this the same year?
Right. No, I mean, this movie does have a visual signature. I mean, it has an identity.
It's got lots of camera movement. It's very well shot.
Yep.
You know, what should be stock isn't. It really does. It really is just. And then you get to that final chase scene. And that final chase scene has this really great look to it.
Yeah. Well, it's got that one steady long shot where you can see both Predator and Prey. Kind of, you can see... You know, the guy chasing her way off in the distance, and you can see the gap. You can visually watch the gap close.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting way to shoot a chase.
And then it has the most 80s soundtrack of all time.
That it does.
It really, like, when you listen to this, it almost feels like if... You know the guys who are out there right now in the indie world and in the indie junk food world who are making 80s parodies? They're just lifting this soundtrack.
Pretty much.
Like,
yeah.
It's like this has everything. It has the late 70s, early 80s suspense strings, the Buck Rogers.
And then it's got this really great soundtrack whenever... Charles Bronson locks eyes with his killer that just sounds like somebody like clapping. It's like, I don't know.
It's got
like,
chimes in there. Yeah, like yeah. It's like so of the, like it's such a weird mix of really great talent struggling against the schlock of its time.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting, outcome. And it's a movie that I really can strongly recommend. It's one of those movies that you watch it for the first hour and you're like, okay, this is the type of movie that I like watching with a beer on a Friday night. And when it takes its turn in the third act, you're just like, holy fuck, this is a real movie.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think it's one of those perfect movies that's like, perfectly set up for a great remake.
Yeah,
like
no, I would agree with that.
It's one of those movies that if you were like, okay, we're going to remake 10 to Midnight, people would be like, really? And then you go back and rewatch 10 to Midnight and go, oh yes. Like yeah. you put A-list talent and make this like a Fincher-esque kind of noir and you've got yourself a hit film because the story is so great.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of the writing really holds up. Like there's some really like quippy, like smart writing in there that just makes you laugh and moves on and doesn't give you the pause to laugh. It's just like, you're either laughing or you're not, we're moving on. Yeah. And it's really good.
And I'm glad you brought up Fincher because I'm going to preface this heavily. I'm going to talk about the ending of this movie. Do not listen to this part of the show if you haven't seen. Go watch 10 to Midnight and then come back and listen to this last segment because I really want to talk about the ending of this movie because I think it's what makes this such a different film for Bronson.
Yes.
So, major spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Okay. So, at the end of the movie, after the chase, after the after our villain basically butchers, you know, all the nurses in the dormitory save for Charles Bronson's daughter, he's surrounded by cops, the chase is over, it's obvious he's going back to jail, and the killer, when he's cornered by police, launches into this speech about how he's sick, and that all society can do is lock him up, and then that he'll get out and do it again.
You can't punish me! I'm sick! You can't punish me for being sick! All you can do is lock me up, but not forever! One day I'll get out! One day they'll get out! That's the law! That's the law! That's the law! And I'll be back! I'll be back! You'll hear from me! You and the whole fucking world!
No, we won't.
Okay, you just heard it. Bronson says, you know, when he's like, you'll be seeing me, he's like, no, we won't, and he shoots him in the head. The thing to remember about this moment in the movie, Bronson's character is not a cop anymore.
No, he's been fired.
Okay, so when he shoots the killer in the head while the police have him encircled, he's committed first-degree murder in front of a like cadre of police officers.
Yeah. The cops might come out for him, but odds are they're not.
Yeah.
Like, it's the way the movie has set it up. It's set up a situation where you fully expect this guy's going to be in prison, but you know he's going to do it because that's the kind of guy this guy is.
Evil is punished, but our hero is likely going to jail, and it's such a direct contrast to, you know, the Death Wish movies where Bronson can level an entire city block and walk away clean. And it reminded me most of the ending of Seven, where someone has literally placed a challenge in front of a cop, like, you know, you're going to kill me, and, you know, I'm going to make you kill me. And that decision, the act of doing that one simple act of violence that on a completely moral baseline, you know, he's punished evil, but at the same time, at what cost? I mean, this is a really dark, very compelling ending that is so different from the way most Bronson movies ends, which is just, yeah, killed a bunch of people, goodbye, see you next week. Like, this is
This is so
You can't
much,
stop him.
Yeah. It's so much grittier and so much more complicated.
He got so, you know, we talk about Bronson the superhero. They got to the point that they made him the Secret Service agent who protects the First Lady from fucking terrorists.
Yes.
And like defeats the terrorists. Like that is not, this is very much the ending, which I think this is how they managed to get what you talked about at the very beginning of this episode, where how they got Bronson on board to do this was like, look, you want to do this movie that has this very strong moral center. That's exactly what we've got here. We've got a movie. We can't afford to do that. You need to make a movie. We need to make a movie with you. We have something with a moral center that leaves you in a very fucked up place. Do you want to do it? And Bronson's like, yeah, sure. Let's do this. Because Bronson was a working actor. It's mm-hmm. why Bronson kept doing that. It's why he kept on in the cheese factory in the 80s. It was because Bronson was one of those guys. You know, I actually one time I sat down with Clue Gulager, who I'm a
speaking of working actors,
and chatted with him, and I was asking him about, you know, the old days, and asked him about some of the movies he worked on, and he worked with Charles Bronson. And I said, "What was it like to work with, you know, Charles Bronson?" He's like, "Charlie." Oh, Charlie was always working. And he went on to just tell me about, you know, the fact that he was one of those guys who he would show up on time every day. He would know what he was supposed to do. He was blue collar. He ate lunch with everybody else. You know, he was there to work, and then he would punch out at the end of the day, and he'd go and he'd get drunk, and then he'd come back and he'd do it again the next day. He was just like, he was just like any factory worker or any other worker at the time, that's how he viewed acting. He was not one of these guys who viewed it as an art. He was a guy who really wanted to do it and was just always there and would always give you what you asked for. Mm-hmm. And it's like, look, this is my job. I signed the contract. You gave me my check. I'm here. Yeah. And so he wanted to keep working, but he wanted to do something, you know, a little better. And I think that's why he ended up doing this.
Except, I mean, he's very blue collar, except that when Charles Bronson punches out, people get bruised. That happens. Well, again, this is a movie. 10 to Midnight is a film that you probably feel like you know everything that's going to happen. It looks very formulaic from the outside. Oh, it's Charles Bronson versus a naked killer. Super exploitation. But there's so many more interesting things going on just beneath the surface of this film that if you actually take the time to watch it and you get behind the idea that, like we said, it's not a rip-roaring good time. It's not a lot of fun. It's just a very well-made movie.
It's just good.
It has its flaws, but overall, it is very compelling and does things that you don't expect. And this is a movie that is well worth your time, and for more than just the exploitation gimmick of a naked serial killer or Charles Bronson versus a naked serial killer.
I'm not a nice person. I'm a mean, selfish son of a bitch.
Well, that brings us to the junk food pairing, and I'm really excited about this week's.
You really are. Like, you sold me on this earlier. You're like, I can't wait, I can't wait. I'm like, all right, let's blow through this episode. Let's get to the junk food pairing.
You ready for this?
Lay us out.
Quesarito. Are you familiar with the Taco Bell Quesarito?
No.
Okay. So, in the real world, when the clock strikes 10 to midnight, if you find yourself racked by hunger pangs, it's fourth meal time. So you head to your loco Taco Bell, and you might notice on the menu a little junk food mashup dubbed the Quesarito. This is a quesadilla wrapped in a burrito. Now, like the mashup of police procedural serial killer movie and slasher film, you might notice that the two elements of the Quesarito are not terribly dissimilar from one another. Not only that, but in 10 to Midnight, it's really the police procedural that's pulling the lion's share of the load. With the Quesarito, let's be honest, it's mostly a quesadilla with only the vague shell of a burrito present to justify the combo. Also, our killer in 10 to Midnight chooses to use a Mexican accent when he calls to harass his victims.
He does.
Turns out, his Mexican accent sounds like your most racist uncle doing an impression of the Taco Bell Chihuahua.
It's pretty close.
It's pretty awful. And my name is Pedro. It means Peter. And I've got the biggest one you've ever seen. Now imagine that with a horribly contrived Mexican accent. And you basically got the gist. And that is why I have gone with the Quesarito at 10 to midnight, your fourth meal as you watch 10 to midnight. The Quesarito.
Tell me we got a check for that.
We didn't.
Oh no!
I know, it's terrible.
Oh,
like,
oh, we're pimping for Taco Bell and we're not even getting whore money.
All of the shits and none of the money. We're doing it wrong.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be continuing March Madness all month long. I want to let you know once again that the podcast is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
How's that beer working out for you?
Those beers are working magnificently. or you can find me on facebook.com/massaworm.
Fantastic. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find my Facebook page on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And I want to let you know, too, oneofus.net, which is my home away from home. Lots of great geek podcasts and blogs. We're gearing up for our South by Southwest coverage, so definitely keep an eye on what's going on over there. And, yeah, this has been fun. I really, like, this is one of my deep-fried favorites. I love Charles Bronson. I love Canon Films. This is one of my favorite collaborations. And I love J. Lee Thompson.
Well, you know, and I'm just going to give a brief shout out. We've been doing this officially a year.
Oh my gosh,
this
we have.
This has been a year. And
holy shit, and it has been a year.
It has been a year.
I feel like I should have gotten you something.
Herpes. I've never quite given a shout out to my wife, who is like the center of my life. This month, you can thank my wife, where, you know, I was sitting at home and I was like, oh yeah, me and Brian need to brainstorm another month because we're really enjoying doing these months. Because we were just so scattershot early on, because we were just doing all the stuff we wanted to do, and then stuff would fall by the wayside. We really are enjoying these theme months. And I was like, what do we do? And my wife, Jessica, was just like, March Madness. Talk about movies with crazy people. And I was like, holy God. And so she and I sat around for half an hour talking about our favorite crazy people movies. And then I brought it to Brian, and Brian goes, 10 to midnight. We're doing 10 to midnight. I'm like, fuck yeah, Charles Bronson. Hell yeah, I'm in. And then sure enough, here we are. So thank you, Jessica, for giving us March Madness.
A very good idea. I'm very impressed with the idea, and I'm looking forward to sharing with you guys the things we have on deck. But for now, I'm going to end this episode. So for Cargill, this is Brian reminding you that when you go into that courtroom, or a food court, let's be real, forget what's legal, just do what's right.